Okay, I've allowed an LSE 5 minutes. It's just after 6:30, and one or two people are still arriving, but let's begin. My name's Tony Travers from the Government Department and the Institute of Public Affairs here at the LSE, and indeed LSE London, lots of titles. Welcome to those of you who are from outside the school and to those of you who are on the Executive Masters, doubly welcome. Good to see you all. Now, what I'm going to do is really introduce Philip Roeder, who is going to introduce the evening, so I'm just the warm-up act, really. This is a public lecture and indeed a discussion, a panel discussion, about urban governance and the new urban agenda and on the implication for governments. As Philip pointed out to me, it's very noble of you to come here on the 14th of February, and I'm sure you'll all, your noble folk, giving up a Valentine's Day treat to come here, or have one later. We live in a time of cities. We live in a time of cities, and more of the world lives in cities today than at any time in history. But, of course, the more cities we have and the greater the scale of the needs of urban areas, and many of them are not recognizable perhaps as cities in the way they would have been 500 years ago in medieval Europe, there is a demand for governance, something that's broader than people in charge running public services and telling people what to do, but a much broader understanding of an elite or a coalition of elites, but then needing to interact with populations, interests, often in developing cities, all cities actually, in a way that is very different to the way in which, even in London in the early to mid-20th century, and in British cities like Birmingham and Manchester in the middle of the 20th century, would have been seen as the norm, which is in effect a powerful elite doing things, often without much involvement, much participation, much capacity for those who live in the city to be involved. And by the way, we know more about cities, we know more about a whole range of issues that affect them and the way the interconnectedness of people who live in cities and the corporations that operate in cities need other individuals and other organizations to be regulated in order that life is better for everyone. We now understand a great deal about regulations, about externalities, and about the challenges that living in a place where millions of people live in a relatively concentrated place, which is good for agglomeration economics, it's good for people. You know, it is good indeed for meeting and for networking and all the things that generate productivity. But this requires somebody or some body of individuals, governance, to make this all work and to deal with these complex problems that are thrown up by so many people attempting to live so close to each other. So I'll say no more than that by way of my introduction. I will introduce the panel members afterwards, but I'm going to retreat down to the front row and introduce Philip Roeder, who is the executive director and one of the founding brains of LSE Cities, who is going to speak this evening, or to open up this evening with a lecture about the subject, and then we'll draw the panel up and discuss what Philip has said, no doubt have an argument, and you can all join in. Philip.
So, thank you very much, Tony, and as you mentioned, I'm really going to only set the scene. This is not like a public lecture where it's all about me and my thoughts. It's much more about introducing the discussion we want to have tonight. Now, what you see on this photograph is Quito, the Habitat 3 conference, which claims to have spoken on behalf of all of us when it's about the global urban future. And as a means of testing the representativeness of what happened there, I just wonder who in the audience has either been in Quito for Habitat 3 or has been working as part of the process in the run-up of Habitat 3. Hands up, just to get a bit of a sense. Okay, that's not bad, given that we are many thousand kilometers away from the UN and certainly also from Quito. For those that haven't been there, certainly urbanists last year felt that they were going through a process which was momentous, Every 20 years, the United Nations holds a major global conference and produces a major internationally agreed, though not legally binding, document called Urban Agenda, and in this case, the New Urban Agenda. And that's precisely the content of my introductory presentation, a reflection on how some of the thinking, maybe we want to even call it creative thinking, about the governance component of the New Urban Agenda by experts, by academic scholars, by practitioners, has then actually been integrated as part of the policy-making phase and the diplomacy which negotiated the ultimate document. So what I'm going to do, therefore, is really building on the work which a so-called policy unit, of which there were 10 in total, building on the work of the policy unit LSE Cities, was co-leading with UCLG, that is United Cities and Local Governments, with a focus on urban governance, capacity, and institutional development. Now, these policy units were a very unique and new vehicle for the United Nations to allow experts who are not part, formally part, of member states and are representative of, therefore, the global political negotiation. It was the first time in a UN process where this expert input was actually taken quite serious, and where even experts like myself and many colleagues from around the world were allowed to speak at the United Nations to member states. So all the 198 member states represented in the room and listening to people who come sort of from the knowledge perspective rather than the political perspective to this theme. So 10 policy units in total, which prepared all sorts of urban relevant themes. As I said, we were helping on the theme of urban governance, but we weren't alone. This is a list of 20 experts, and 20 experts was the number for each of the policy units, which were chosen by the United Nations through their member states, considering all sorts of issues of global equity, about gender balance, about regional distribution, and the result is the following. And I really have to emphasize that what I'm going to show and the work which we have been conducting from 2015 and 16 is the result of a deep collaboration between these colleagues from very different backgrounds, from very different personal experiences with cities and urban governance, and then co-producing this piece of work, which, surprisingly enough, and I'm going to share with you sort of the test to what extent the thinking from the experts was then reflected in the political document. What we then want to do tonight is discuss how realistic is all of this and does it matter? Is this document worth anything? And if so, how will it materialize in the foreseeable future? So, for us, an important starting point was to reflect, and this is, when I say us, it's the policy unit 4, to reflect on key institutional challenges which cities are facing, of which there are many. I, at this point, just want to highlight three, which are probably very obvious to you, but which nevertheless were very important to re-emphasize as part of our conversations with member states and the United Nations. And first and foremost, and this is something any person who worked or who works in city government will recognize, is that cities have enormous responsibilities, but rarely are these responsibilities mirrored by the fiscal, by the political powers and competencies which enable cities to fully deliver those responsibilities. Any person who has ever been elected to office in an urban context will be very familiar with the limitations you ultimately have to deal with the enormous challenges you are facing. And this goes across all sectors, whether they are more urban relevant or less. There's always this kind of deficit, this difference between what's expected from you as an urban leader or as an urban government more generally, and what you can actually do. There's also a big question about political power and the extent to which not only governments, with T, but governance more generally, which includes, of course, other forms of contributing to collective decision-making, is included as part of this story. What you can see here is the result of a survey, which we ran in partnership with UN Habitat and UCLG, of about 100 cities worldwide, looking at how citizens are actually engaging with decision-making at the urban level. And not surprisingly, by far the most important vehicle of influencing what's happening in cities still today are elections and voting. But other areas are coming up fast. In particular, social media is something which we hear a lot about from cities. It's becoming more relevant. The indirect, the soft power through pressuring, public hearings, formal petitions, and so it goes on. Even participatory budgeting is something which has become more and more important, even outside the context where it was originally introduced, which is Brazil. And we even now have in Paris, for example, a context that relies on elements of the budget being decided through participatory practices. And third, very obvious, there is the metropolitan challenge, by which we mean the gap between literally the geography, a mayor, a political institution responsible for urban governance, what this area looks like and how that is contrasted by the actual, you could say, the functional urban region, the actual city, the extent to which a functional region operates together, a labor market area, for example. And what you can see here is for a selected number of cities, the contrast between this political administrative city in red and then all sorts of estimates, because it's actually very hard to determine what is then the metropolitan region or this functional urban region, and therefore in the shades of grey you have then these different sizes, as we would, at this point only suggest what it could be. In many of these places, significantly larger than the political city. And that leads to all sorts of institutional deficiencies and problems, of which London is a good example, and we may be able to come back to. We nowadays are very happy that London, in the region of the 8.8 million inhabitants, has a government, but it actually functions as a metropolitan region of maybe 20 million people, for which there is no coherent way of formulating policy. The word which we implied, or which we explored further as part of urban governance and our sort of contributions to the area, since we're talking about the new urban agenda, was then, of course, new urban governance. And early on, I think there was quite an agreement what are the constituent parts of new urban governance. And I want to introduce those very briefly to then move on to the priority actions which we identified and how they're reflected in the actual document. We thought and we believe that new urban governance needs to be democratic and inclusive. Obviously, it doesn't need to be emphasized here in this very theater, but in other parts of the world, this is still important. It needs to be long-term and strategic. It needs to be multi-scale and multi-level. So very important coordination between different tiers of government and also sectors of decision-making. It needs to be territorial, i.e. an acute awareness of the physical relationships of different areas, which other tiers of government often struggle with. It needs to be proficient, a link to the skills required, and it needs to be conscious of the digital age. So I'll now finish with a contrasting of the priority actions which we identified in the run-up. So this is a period of about a year before the negotiations happened, and then how our initial input was taken forward by diplomats and how ultimately it was then included or reinterpreted as part of the document as you can download it today. Before I go there, here is the big overview summary of all those chapters in the new urban agenda that relate to the governance story and the institutional story. And this is interesting insofar as it immediately points you towards one of the biggest tensions we just need to continue talking about, which is the tension between the national and the local. These are the biggest words and the most frequent references you find in the document. And clearly, this is the unsolved relationship. And I think it's fair to suggest right from the beginning that, of course, this is a document which primarily addresses nation states, rather cities. It's negotiated by nation states. That this relationship, the local-national, is at the heart of the struggle and will remain to be at the heart of the struggle. I'm sure we hear more about it today. In terms of actions, a term which we used almost as a synonym for urban governance was multi-level governance. There was an agreement amongst practitioners and experts that it's very hard to define urban governance as something which only is conducted by city governments. No, it's actually conducted by all sorts of governments at different levels. There are many national governments which do urban governance. But what you need to do in order to make this a dynamic and also proficient exercise is ensure that there is a coordination in place where it's clear who leads on what and where there are frequent engagements across those levels, i.e. vertical integration. That was a very important input from our group, almost the most important high-level input. And how is this reflected in the new urban agenda? I'm now always quoting literally from the document. Well, it's not really reflected at all. The term multi-level comes up just a very few times, and in this case, with a very weak reference to something which refers to consultation mechanisms which need to be multi-level. While, yes, acknowledging that we need to more clearly define the respective competences at different levels of governance. So at least in the definitional space, we have made progress. That is something which the UN acknowledged. The next very important agenda item is decentralization, or devolution, as it's usually referred to in the UK context. Not surprisingly, that's often referred to in this country in particular, because if you look at the current degree of decentralization in this chart by the OECD, which gives you a sense of the fiscal revenue distribution across governance levels, the UK is very much on the left, heavily centralized, the polar opposite of my home country, Germany, where you have a far greater degree, of course, of a federal regime in place with municipalities raising their own taxes and having a solid tax base. And the UK, and I'm sure we'll come back to this with Tony, has probably accepted that to a degree they need to embrace a degree of further devolution, a further decentralization. And if there's one term which actually the urban community has really taken forward, is to say powers need to become more local. National governments have been keeping too much of these things, of the decision-making related to cities, to themselves, and they need to change that approach. How is decentralization reflected in the new urban agenda? Well, this was a surprise because it's rather explicit in there, and not only rather explicit, the new urban agenda also borrows one of the key terms of the European Union here, which is the principle of subsidiarity, which basically suggests that you want to devolve the powers as much as possible to the most local level, in some ways possible. So appropriate fiscal, political, and administrative decentralization specifically mentioned, and not only that, the term fiscal decentralization comes up, but is immediately sort of nuanced with this reference to where available. So that gives an easy way out for governments who are not interested in really giving proper powers further down the line. A further area of great concern and priority was this idea of integrated urban policy making. Now, we all probably know from experiences in working in cities that the policy complementarities, so the overlaps between transport and health policy, for example, or urban planning and transport, are particularly pronounced at the urban level. And this has led to a very strong narrative around ensuring greater integratedness at the city level, taking often very siloed and sectoral policy in terms of legal and fiscal structures from national governments, bits and pieces, taking those from individual departments and making sense of it in a more holistic way. And cities are probably, and our work shows this also empirically, best equipped to deal more holistically with decision making. So this needs to be strengthened and furthered in the future. How is it reflected in the new urban agenda? Interestingly, it's linked to one very important substantive policy concern, and that is urban sprawl. The integration story in the new urban agenda is directly linked to integrated urban planning to prevent urban sprawl. That's interesting. I mean, for people like myself working in this space, it's probably the primary motivation why we want to talk about integrated policy making. This is clearly picked up, but it also goes clearly against, or entirely against, the way the world is currently moving. So another important point to discuss. I already referred to metropolitan governance. Here a nice visualization, which we prepared at LSE Cities for our own urban governance conference in 2014, which looks at the distribution here in terms of residential densities of urban populations and then superimposes in red the actual political boundary of the city. And you can just see, for the case of Bogota and Tokyo, how artificial this boundary drawing exercise is. It doesn't really respond at all to the functional urban region. And that sort of cutting the cake in an artificial way leads to all sorts of very, very problematic sort of policy-making problems, and therefore has been reflected quite aggressively in the New Urban Agenda. In fact, the New Urban Agenda talks about new legal frameworks and reliable financing mechanisms for metropolitan governance. This took us entirely by surprise, that national governments would go that far. And they also specifically referred to metropolitan plans and planning as something which national governments need to very much push forward. We've talked about the culture of participation and equity as part of our efforts to ensure that this important aspect of further democratizing decision-making is included in the new urban agenda. And while you find a range of different references around civic engagement and a sense of belonging, full and meaningful participation, not much is really said about how this can become more powerful as a mechanism. And we all know why that is. Very complicated territory. By the way, the word democratization or democracy is entirely sort of edited out of these kind of UN documents. And the last two, capacity building, very central. How do we strengthen capacity building? That's indeed included. There are a range of references, and obviously as a university, as an educational institution, this was a particularly interesting component. But beyond the actual recognition of that capacity building need, in terms of actual finance or actual commitments to helping cities out of this trap of lacking and lagging capacity, there is not too much included. By contrast, the references to digital era governance and monitoring and taking advantage of what some people refer to as smart city innovation is something which ultimately did correspond to some of the thinking the sort of negotiators had in mind, and you'll find references to e-government strategies and a very, I think, positive evaluation of the role of geospatial information systems. A very technical term in some ways, but those that have worked in urban research for the last decades will know that GIS has really revolutionized the analysis of cities, and it's now time that it also helps with the practice and the decision-making around cities. So I will leave you with this. This is the a photograph of the conference center at the heart of Quito. And what we want to do now for the rest of this evening is to really discuss how much of this stuff is actually realistic, will it be taken forward, if so, by which countries, and which elements are maybe completely unrealistic to work towards. And hopefully we can then also discuss how we can become more concrete with regards to some of these still rather generic objectives. Thank you very much.
Join us up here.
Right. Now, I have four panel members. Henk Oving, Claire Short, Philip, who's just spoken, and Sue Parnell. And what I'm going to do is to ask each of them to respond briefly to what Philip has said, just an opening statement, but to preface that with a few words about their own interest in the subject, what they're doing today, rather than me read out a biography, that each of you read out a biography, or at least say a few words about yourself. So shall I start, Sue, and just run along from right to left?
Oh,
she's
yes.
Got no
microphone. It's
a recording, you know.
Ah, there you go. So I'm based at the University of Cape Town, and through the African Centre for Cities, at least in part, I was very directly involved in the New Urban Agenda's formation. I was on another of the policy groups and was quite involved in something called the National Urban Policy discussion. And so both that and because I was quite involved in the creation of an urban sustainable development goal, I suppose, had a direct engagement with this process. And so it's been quite useful to have to begin to change gears to think about a formative process and now to begin to start thinking about, okay, and now?
Very good. Okay. Claire.
I'm the chair of an organization called Cities Alliance, which used to be hosted in the World Bank and was co-chaired by the World Bank and UN Habitat and was a partnership for kind of small grants to encourage more knowledge and activity on managing urbanisation better and upgrading slums and looking forward to cities without slums. It's now more than 10 years old. It's now based in Brussels and has a wider set of partners and works in South America, South Asia, but particularly Africa, and particularly focused on secondary cities, and trying to get both ambition so that local government, central government, civil society come together and think together about what needs to be done, and also to get development partners to work coherently rather than having lots of little projects all over the place, which... Is the practice. And are we meant to answer these questions, or is that enough for now?
Well, I'll just sing a little introduction now, just to get us going.
Okay, yes,
then
yes.
We'll come back, of course. Hank.
I'm Hank Govink. I'm Special Envoy for International Water Affairs. So what has that got to do with cities? Background in planning and water and cities are critical across the world, one of their biggest risks, but also opportunities. And that brings me to governance and the risk of the urban agenda. As Tony asked, a reflection is that on one hand, there is it's addressed the idea of decentralization, which is picked up, but on the other, multi-level governance is not there. So before you know it, the burden is all put on the local level without actually having a real collaborative effort from a national level. And the urban agenda is only signed off by the national level. So here's a big tension, especially in regards to climate change.
Very good. Now, we'll have a bit of a discussion here for a while, and then I want, obviously, to bring members of the audience in as well. But as Claire quite rightly asked me, are we going to answer the questions? Do you want to have a go at the first one, as you seem to be itching to go for it, which is, what are the concrete actions may be taken now in your city? Choose a city that you know. Aligned with the urban governance components. I mean, we'll just muse on the subject.
Okay, well, I mean, I live in the UK, which is massively highly centralised. Nothing that's in the new urban agenda is remotely being implemented or has any chance of being. And in fact, what's going on is that the cuts, the austerity is being delivered by central government, forcing local government to do all the cutting. Right. So it's losing capacity more and more. And then there's a synthetic, oh, we'll have a mayor of London and pretend he's got powers and we'll have a northern... So that's the country I live in.
Anyway, you'd like to be more optimistic about... Well,
in terms of working in secondary cities in Africa, I think the first thing to say is that the theory of the UN processes is that governments come together and agree on strategies that they all support, and then they go out and implement them and share knowledge and technical assistance and drive the world forward and monitor progress. I think very few governments are really committed to the implementation of this agenda. But that doesn't mean it didn't matter your work. This is the best thinking about what should be done. But it will be done in a few places that hopefully will become exemplary, and then good habits will spread. But in the meantime, the driver of change is going to be angry people. Which I think it was also in Birmingham and Britain. It wasn't just technocrats that did it.
No.
There were angry people that made the technocrats start to change what was done.
And even in a centralised country, any centralised country, and Philip's chart does show a remarkable range with the UK at one end, but lots of other countries at that end, others at the other end, and all countries can be fit on an equivalent spectrum. The truth is that people other than national governments do pick up ideas, don't they? They they go to conferences, and you get local and regional governments, and then agitation at that level, which can do things at that level or change national government or federal government policy.
Absolutely. I mean, in Africa's secondary cities, I don't think many central governments have got much plan to decentralise power and to give fiscal... But you've got all these very resourceful, articulate slum dwellers who really want some change and who are getting together and organising remarkably in saving groups and bringing their voice forward. And they're the engine of change. And they were represented in Quito, and they know about what they're supposed to be entitled to. So that's my optimism.
Okay. South Africa. South Africa's changed, in many political, cultural, economic ways in the last 20, 30 years, more than anybody would have thought possible, I guess. And a lot of these issues have been confronted, haven't they? And in the sense that there was a lot of thought put into, after apartheid, coming into possibility of using that change to deliver other changes to government systems. Is that right?
Yes, and I think it's an interesting moment to reflect from South Africa, because it's 20 years after democracy, it's 20 years after you have to think about, did we achieve what we thought we might achieve? And the New Urban Agenda is really important in that regard, because there is an intense political fight going on about cities. Now, it's not the only country in the world where that's the case. This one, America. But in the African context, the fight about whether cities matter or not is a really profound one. It's also a fight about in what way cities that do matter should be governed. So they're quite contradictory things happening in the South African context, which relate to what will South Africa do in terms of the New Urban Agenda. So on the one hand, South Africa is a much more devolved power than the UK. 80% of metropolitan revenue is generated by cities themselves. And there are attempts to get further powers given to those metros. So significant. So 80% is not enough. We want to ensure that where there is capacity, there can be additional capacity. Having said that, you have an extremely anti-metropolitan national government who is absolutely concerned to centralize and is particularly unwilling, and it's the point Claire's just made for the rest of the African continent, unwilling and to some extent with some cause, reluctant to give power to the local scale in a context where there is no clarity, there is no clear governance regime, where there's no clear political authority, and where there are competing political authorities. So I think South Africa will be an interesting one to watch in the sense that it's a little bit at the crossroads in terms of how in fact does the discourse about a new urban agenda get traction, and what does it look like in 10 or 15 years' time when we look back and we say what's changed?
I remember in the early days, when change was appeared to be about to start, talking with folk from Johannesburg about the possibility of something that was dear to my heart from studying it in this country, which was an equalisation arrangement. That is, the idea that your government system could embrace rich and poor areas, tax them all through a single system, but then distribute resources, not exactly by stealth, but through the action of the automatic action of government, providing services which were consistent. And that seemed an easier sell than, redistributing resources explicitly. Now, did such ideas, have they worked through in any way? They have.
Yes, the great misunderstanding is to assume that middle-income countries have just been neoliberal. I think if you have a look at the rise of social transfers, not just in South Africa, but in places like Mexico, and to some extent even in India, the increase in a cash transfer and an indirect transfer to very large numbers of people is taking place not just through national governments. Okay. So whether that's through a water subsidy or whether it's through a transport subsidy, That is advancing. It's probably the big social revolution of our time. Whether it is able to reach the kinds of cities that Claire is talking about, where we don't even know who lives there, let alone how to actually reach them, that's a much more difficult question. And what kinds of skills, what kinds of knowledge do you need to have in order to affect that kind of redistribution is very difficult. And how do you begin to tax the local 1%, not the global 1%, the local 1%? How do you begin to affect redistribution in what are increasingly unequal countries? That, I think, is stuff that the New Urban Agenda actually talks about, because it talks about inequality. It doesn't just talk about poverty.
And Hank, your experience, which many of us know you for, and not only this, obviously, was in arriving in a major developed city after it had suffered a significant calamity, really. It's a disaster, natural disaster. And I suppose the question that, in this context, it's interesting to ask you is, in a sense, how far was there a willingness for the existing built machinery of government and governance institutions to change, given that adapting, and I don't mean environmentally adapting, but adapting to change is essential for any political and governmental system if it's to be able to move on and reform. I mean, did you meet that kind of willingness for institutions to change?
Yes and no, of course. Yes, because of a disaster like that and the incentive. Also, yes, because of a president that started with at least the ambition to put the city on the agenda, as well as disaster response. In the words of Obama in his first term was, no Katrina on my watch. I don't want to see non-functioning federal government that only can send in the army instead of aid and funding capacity to a region at risk. But the conditions in the New York region are very complex. You have voluntary mayors on the Jersey Shore. There are no mayors on Long Island. And you have a big shot mayor in New York City, a New Jersey constitution that is run by a Republican governor, which is totally different, not only the governor, but also the constitution, from that of New York State. So it gives the, and then Connecticut, which is adjacent and impacted by a storm like that, with no position on the local level. So from a federal perspective, building capacity on the local level was one aim. But if you look now, and actually cities were doing that and picking up that transformative capacity because they were given the trust and the funding and the collaboration from a federal side. But now moving to the Trump era, where cities are the scare for the Republican Party, and actually the political power tried to dismantle that capacity, nobody knows where this will head.
But interesting, we've come up three times this evening against an interesting, in a different way in each occasion, that federal, national governments are either over-centralized or not that interested in metro or city government, or afraid of it in some
right.
Often afraid of it. So I know Philip's waiting to come in, but just let me pursue this with Claire, who is a UK cabinet minister, so right at the top of government. I mean, why is there a fear of cities having power, or, you know, not blaming you personally for this, by the way, but, you know, not blaming all for it, but why is it so difficult for national politicians to at least to let go and respect that metropolitan areas, and indeed rural and semi-rural areas, have their own legitimate right to make these decisions?
I think it's control freakery, wanting to be in charge, wanting to be powerful. I mean, this argument that power has seeped away from the nation states and that governments now are desperate to show their power and so on. I mean, if you look at the chart that Philip put up, in Britain, water, education, energy, security, none of those are controlled by local government. And indeed, central government has taken education away from local government and taken the curriculum away from academic experts. Now, why? I think in the case of Britain, it isn't fear of the population. I think it's we're big cheeses, we're in control, we want to show that we're in control of everything. And this very bureaucratic control freakery that you saw under New Labour and continues, I think that was the explanation.
I should add that Claire is originally from Birmingham, which in Britain is the acme of 19th and early 20th century municipal, very good municipal government. I mean, the acme in this country. Philip.
Thank you, Tony. I just felt that it may be worth quickly going back to Claire's earlier point about what's the value of this UN process and, in fact, this UN document. And I think from an urban perspective, the last 3 years, 2 years, have actually seen the rollout of three very influential pieces which are now constantly referred to. And I guess there's a hierarchy to what extent they actually impact on the real world beyond just, you know, the angry crowd which makes the world change. So first, I would mention the Paris Agreement, which clearly without an angry crowd on the ground, if it's not going to be completely rejected by the Trump administration, is going to change the world fairly dramatically with that sort of, yes, very bureaucratic, technocratic process. Very complicated, but it has certain teeth. It is legally binding. There are very clear processes in place. Now, there's a second level, which are the so-called SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, which for the first time also include urban sustainable development goals, already a bit weaker. But if you think about what the Millennium Development Goals did, they somehow had a degree of, you know, informal power in steering and, you know, creating a bit of noise and energy amongst those that were trying to work with it. Now, the new urban agenda is the least potent of these documents. It's also often framed as a response to the other two, i.e. the new urban agenda as the implementation tool for delivering Paris, for delivering the SDGs. So before entirely, I think, dismissing the value of the document, I just wonder, it may be interesting to unpack.
No, I didn't dismiss the value of the document.
As in having sort of...
I mean, it's important, that consensus, that good thinking, yeah. But all I'm saying is the assumption that governments are bound to it because they all signed up to it and they're all going to go out and implement it,
no,
that would be naive.
Yeah. But I think then let's take it forward towards how is it then impacting if it's not in that sort of direct, you know, bureaucratic way.
I'm happy to.
Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, if you've read the New Urban Agenda, you will know that it is almost impossible to summarise. Even Google Summary is not going to do it, okay? Which tells you that even if everybody did implement it, it would be very difficult to tell because, yeah. However, having said that, and I think what we have to be really careful of is to be dismissive as a result of that. And Claire's point about it's the state of the art thinking. It is a state of, and in contemporary language, we would have a thinkings, an S on the end of it, because it really, there are multiple and potentially very contradictory ideas in that document. But for me, speaking in the African context, I think what I am really struck by, and particularly in contrast, I was in Europe last week talking to some of the people from the European Union who have a platform for the discussion of urban questions. They have mechanisms for the implementation of their commitments to the urban agenda, to the SDGs, to the Paris Agreement. They are communities of practice where people talk about cities and how they might change. Now, for Africa, that's new. That's really, really new. And so what the New Urban Agenda was able to do, in part, because you've seen a much more active mobilization of the Africans within the G77 and within the UN process more generally, is it's the beginnings of the coming together to find voice, to find a position, to compare. And so I would argue that the real value of the New Urban Agenda is actually not at the local level, probably. It's actually at this kind of quite macro scale where you begin to get an intellectual leadership which begins to cut and thrust, begins to debate what is really a viable, sort of the new municipalism, if you like, of the 21st century will come out of this kind of dialogue.
I mean, I'm going to open this to the audience. I'm now going to risk it, by really. I'm going to say something about Donald Trump in a positive way, which is this. I mean, the thing about Donald Trump is that he, whether you like him or not, he comes up with an idea and finds a way of convincing a large number of people to understand it and then to act upon it, i.e. to vote for him. And the point
but
you make
is...
But
what was the idea?
Well, hang on. It kind of doesn't... Well, getting him elected in the first instance. But and therefore promoting the delivery of policies that he, insofar as we know what they are, wants to deliver. And the difficulty, it seems to me, with the, you know, Google can't simplify it problem, is that even though many of the issues embedded in the agenda are rational ones like pollution, which everybody understands, trying to build up a political platform that people can understand is very, very much more difficult than getting Donald Trump elected. I mean, that is surely part of the problem, isn't it?
It is, although I think that the agenda, that the New Urban Agenda says, is a very simple one. It says that cities are important. We cannot think about the future without an urban consciousness and without an urban strategy. And I think that's the message, and that, for most parts of the world, is very radical.
And that they can't be developed without being inclusive.
Absolutely.
Which is deeply radical. Yeah. We went to Quito, and everyone was talking as though we're going to have full equality, no one left behind, every city. And meantime, in the outside world, everything was going in the opposite direction. But that's interesting. Is it out of the cities and the absolute mobilisation and people's demand for a better city for themselves that's very practical and immediate, is that where the new political energy is going to come? I mean, that would be part of my optimistic scenario.
But to a politician or to academics or experts, the question, it seems to me, is how to convince people in a way that it creates the political momentum for action. That's the thing that worries me about, you know, I mean, everybody in the room will broadly agree, I'm guessing, but the trouble is it doesn't quite feed through to the kind of political action that everybody in the room wants.
In a totally different way, sometimes it works. Because, and taking it away from the United States, working around the world in mostly the places at risk, you work with a group of change agents around the world that are in this, as Sue said, in this middle level. They now have a tool, a kit, that you can't summarize, in the way to engage and build capacity in those places. And I already noticed, for instance, working in Myanmar, where Yangon, as a capital city, is at risk. Myanmar is opening up, so there's a lot of international interest, means money going into that place to the wrong projects, building no capacity and no understanding. But thanks to, you know, not only the urban agenda, but having such an agreed upon mechanism, the engagement of a lot of agencies to help build capacity in a city like Yangon can change the perspective from accepting foreign investments for the wrong infrastructure to having a different dialogue on what an inclusive city and a growth perspective might actually be. So in the hands of others, and then the engagement of others in these cities around the world at risk or vulnerable or with lots of opportunities, the agenda actually can be, this is very optimistic, but, you know, it's okay. But then again, I mean, it's not a blueprint. You should not summarize it. It can be a tool for implementation.
Okay, and I want to open this to the floor, and there's one arm helpfully there, the chair's friend. I know the first person to ask a question is always great. So, I guess there's no here, front, one instance. Running the wrong way.
Hello.
Hello, and if you want to, say who you are, but if not, don't.
So, my name's Melda Selhub, consultant. I just wanted to ask about the potential negative consequences of moving power of decentralization. Like, for example, we touched on education. In the US, public schools are funded by district taxes, which means that in high-income areas, the schools are a lot better than in low-income areas. So is there a risk of seeing something like that play out?
Okay, risk of negative, and there's Chuck there, man with an arm up, negative consequences of decentralization, and the third one on the front. Well, we'll take three at a time, so that's three.
Yes.
Yep.
Thank you, first to Philip, for a fantastic presentation and to the panel for the discussion. Gareth Wolfe from the Commonwealth Local Government Forum. I just wanted to ask on the thing about the territorial thing that you brought up. I haven't quite got what exactly you're proposing in terms of how governance should be of a city region or its influence on the rural areas, or that we should just have a bigger metropolitan area and that should have one city government, or is there different models that you think seem to be working, or is it a fluid system of governance or anything like that? Thanks.
Great. And, on the front row here.
Thank you very much. Hastings Chikoko from C40 Cities in Africa. Honorable Short, you have talked about a revolution by angry people or crowds. I just want to ask, how about angry mayors? We have seen in the United States recently a cohort of mayors standing against national government on climate change, on immigration. Is that something that we should be encouraging in other parts of the world, to have these angry mayors leading a revolution on cities?
Okay. Who'd like to go first on any or all of this? Claire?
The first question is really important, because we have to have decentralisation to be able to have competence. But if it's too fast and there's no capacity there, and if there's no agreement on the thing Tony talked about at the beginning, about some kind of redistribution, then it will be a disaster. When I was in government, we were backing the development of local government in Uganda, and things like immunisation of children declined. But just there was goodwill at that time, but the competence at the local level was less. So it's crucial, but it has to be done carefully and strongly with financial backing and with redistribution. And that is not a simple thing. So you pinpoint something very important. Angry mayors is really important, because, of course, you tend to get mayors from the party opposite to the one in government, because the people get cross with whoever the government is. So they might as well be angry and join with their people in being a force for transformation. As you say, they were in the Paris Declaration. Mayors across the world did come together in a very important way. So I think that's part of the process of change, them speaking for their people and then joining up with each other and getting some momentum and power out of that.
To the point of decentralization, it's not black and white, because it's this mix. If it's only about decentralization and, for instance, budget cuts like we've done in the Netherlands, then the burden is again all on the local level, not even creating differences and inequality and strengthening inequality, but just making it impossible for the local level to act upon their responsibilities. In the United States, you see actually that inequality increase with decentralization, but then it's not decentralization, it's just, you know, throwing it down, which is a different form of decentralization, but it's not what the urban agenda is actually talking about. And on the contrast, on the angry male mayors, in the Obama time, we had a lot of collaboration, and we saw a lot of collaboration on the local level between mayors, and they were from both parties. I was on the Sandy Task Force, but we worked closely with the Climate Task Force, the president chaired. And we had mayors from both parties and state governments from both parties in the same room, and they had the same agenda, which was a better life for their constituency, for their citizens. They did not fight each other. There were no tomatoes around the room. They actually agreed upon, without actually discussing perhaps who was at the origin of climate change, ways forward that were very progressive. So I think there's far more hope than angry white male in the United States. Luckily, there are, at the local level, there's a huge amount of capacity among mayors, Republican and Democratic, that really care for the citizens. The question there is the metro scale, which is totally not working at a lot of places in the U.S., where the collaboration across those cities is not happening. So the mayor is the forefront runner of his constituency. Most of the times, I must say, his actually fails in the way of finding a sustainable future for its constituency, because there's a deficit on the regional scale.
This does beg a question, I guess, about the constitution of a country
right. And
the way powers are distributed and spheres of government protected from each other. I just park that thought. It's just it's an issue. Anyway, Philip.
Very briefly on the first point, the New Urban Agenda actually talks about the importance of some kind of territorial equity and redistribution if you decentralize, and those that advocate decentralization in that context would make that point very much so. I also want to take the question on metropolitan governance, and there's an easy and a much more difficult answer. And the easy answer I can also link to sort of my personal reflection on what may happen over the next years, and I think certainly up until recently, in an era of globalization, there's quite a considerable amount of self-interest to at least produce metropolitan accounts. Position yourself in a global world, bigger, more potent, more people, more GDP. That is, you know, you can easily see why this is going to happen and why a lot of metropolitan regions will come together under this banner. A step further beyond just accounts, and we have seen this already, the European Union is sort of establishing more and more systems that allow you to access data for these functional urban regions, which aren't political, and I think the OECD and also UN Habitat, they have efforts in place to promote exactly that kind of accounting. Now, when you start accounting, you start changing perceptions, and then I think you are also getting closer to a world which we are seeing in some countries already, where you are starting to equip this particular regional configuration with certain political powers. And if you want to do that, there are probably four or five very general approaches, which the OECD, by the way, has done very good work on it, globally understanding what are your models of metropolitan governance, which you can choose from. So I think that's actually very, you know, in a technocratic way, fairly easy to answer. What's much more difficult is once you start producing metropolitan region at scale, what is happening with the leftover spaces and how do these connect to those metropolitan regions, i.e. the non-metropolitan hinterlands? And I don't think we have very good answers to this as yet.
Yeah, perhaps, Gareth, just to come to carry on this discussion. I was one of the people who was very frustrated when it was clear that the African Caucus in particular was going to push not just for a focus on cities, but a focus on urbanization and the urban system. So the territorial question, the relationship between places. And that really lies at the heart of the regional question, is what is the city, what's its relationship to the hinterland? And I was frustrated by that because it was the first signs that this was going to be a very vacuous document because we wouldn't agree on what the city was, what the city region was, what its relationship was. In retrospect, I think that they were right. And partly because I think that the real politics is not necessarily just about the very large cities where the internal questions are there, but the fundamental questions of our time actually are about some of these smaller centres where the relationship between them and the relationship to the metropolitan areas is unclear. And for me, the devil is going to be in the detail of how we actually begin, what common language, what approaches we actually begin to put into practice. And this is where I think that the most likely place where that will distill will be in these national urban policies. In other words, when the reporting bodies, national government, to the members of the UN, actually have to begin to say something, not just about what goes on in the cities, which is what I wanted them to say, but also about the kinds of questions of who is responsible for what, how do those powers and functions land, and where are the legal and fiscal responsibilities and the skills capacities to implement those in different places. And I think, I hope, that that discussion will be catalyzed in those national urban policies. But yeah.
Very good. Right. Three more questions. Yep, one there. One right at the back there. Very good. And right to the... Yes, very good. Thanks.
Good evening. My name is Patrick Schumacher. I'm an architect here in town. I wonder if this new urban agenda is framed more towards the developing world, or how you think you're able to formulate a series of key challenges and strategies which are meant to go across all development conditions. And I think I'm very skeptical about this. I might grant you that there is government and governance deficiencies, of course, in sprawling shantytown and agglomerations. But then the way you talk about it, it seems that you're always calling for more scope of powers, the enlargement, metropolitan enlargement of power. There's a kind of sense of where I would want to see that inversed, and really would like to see that distinction. But in your images, you show Bogota and you show Tokyo, this similar problems occur. This distinction is for me very critical, because I would say, with respect to the most advanced countries, we have another problem. I think we have an over-politicized and over-powerful local governments which block a lot of development potentials. And nobody has mentioned so far private actors and potentials and these degrees of freedom in the development process, which for me are a very huge problem, for instance, in London, in New York, etc. So I want to challenge you on that point.
Okay, very good. Challenge is good. Excellent. Now there was a question there and then one down the front.
Hi, I'm a LSE alumni in regional and urban planning, and I've been working as an urban planner in developing countries over the last 5 years. I guess my question is, what, according to your different experiences, was the impact of the previous agenda, in particular Habitat 2? And I'm asking this question because I've been working in different areas for local governments of South America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Southeast Asia. And, well, I've never talked with those different local governments of this agenda, and it seems it has never been a priority for them. But I think the main learning that I got is that this agenda would impact the international donors as an agenda, the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, which will then impact the funding and then the type of infrastructure they will finance. And I think the main sort of direct impact I've seen of this agenda impacting the local agenda priority will be, so I'll give you a concrete example. I was working on the metro of Hanoi last year, and I observed that what really impacted both the agenda and the government structure of the country I was working is was, for example, the social environmental safeguard of the international donors, and the local government would have then to force to adapt it because the funding will depend on these international donors. So quite complicated background, but just a simple question. What was the impact of Habitat
Second?
Impact
of the PATH program. Okay, very good. And then down the front here. Yep.
My name is Phil Ulbrich. I'm LSE alumnus and now with the Warwick Institute of Science of Cities. My question is regarding participation and also the role of technology digital technology for participation. We've seen that participation is still very low in cities, and Hank also gave a good example of Myanmar, how societies and associations got together to improve in order to improve governance, and there are also some examples in water governance in Brazil. So I would be interested to understand how technology, digital technology, can improve participation. Thank you.
Okay. Sue.
I want to come back. I'm going to come back sharply to your question. And it's to say, let's not get ourselves confused. If everybody ran their cities like the so-called best cities in the world are run, we would be in very serious trouble. You're doing it badly. We can't all do it like you do it. They're unequal, they're not sustainable, and it's not a great model. Not a great model for you, and it's not a great model for anybody else. So the fact that the new urban agenda, that the SDGs apply universally, is long overdue. You can't tell other people what to do if you don't do it right yourself. And on cities, we don't do it right in the global north. So I think whether it's on those fundamental kinds of questions, whether it's only government who has to begin to start integrating social, economic and ecological concerns, whether it's only government who says, actually, it's not okay to set one set of minimum standards on water for people who live in Kinshasa and another set of standards of water for people who live in London, I'm happy to debate who should be doing it. But the idea that we have to live in different kinds of cities, or that we have to live in cities where there's a wonderful model, even if it's Stockholm, forget it.
Yeah, and maybe I just want to add that it was surprising in the process, and this is a pure observation of a group of very international, very different people coming together, to what extent there was a convergence of these shared values. And there is one area of the new urban agenda which led to a heated debate and which ultimately was sort of a compromise reference, and that is this idea of the right to the city. That was the one area where there was a lot of pushback from certain countries, which they simply didn't accept that basic principle, and other countries which felt this actually should ideally be the guiding principle for the whole new urban agenda. But it's really, there may be one or two other smaller examples where people completely disagreed on all of those other things, and then, of course, not only that sort of the expert community had a sense of convergence on those items, but then once the diplomats and the nation states came to board, I mean, they seem to have confirmed that. That's it's an observation which is, I think, surprising in some ways. The debates about the universalism, I think, always ended up by highlighting that these are principles. These are sort of a normative agenda, rather than, of course, very concrete advice like you need BRT or you need I don't know what.
Just go straight along this time.
To the first question, I would say what intrigues me about a country like this is how fed up people are and how they're not framing any political power to get some change that they want. And that's why politics is spinning off into these right-wing protest-type movements. I mean, housing is a massive crisis for Britain, and yet nothing is being done. And I presume that's one of the things you're referring to, the Green Belt, etc. But I think if you let the central government do what they want, the people won't get decent, affordable housing. If the people understand that some change at local level would give them that, I think you'd get an eruption of demand for change. So, I mean, that's my answer to your question. There's too much sleepiness in people's disgruntlement in countries like this, and it's coming out in rather ugly ways. On the Habitat 2 previous, there's a guy called Michael Cohen, used to be the World Bank at the New School in New York, and he's got a publication on the impact of Habitat 2, and it shows zilch impact. And I have it on my desk. I mean, you might want to look at it. But my own view is that the debate on urbanisation has strengthened and hotted up. And it isn't just an intellectual thing, it's part of the reality on the ground. And now more people are engaged, more people know something has to be done. So, but if you look at what happened under the previous one, it would make you very cynical. But there is a publication that shows that. And on participation, not so much on the technology point. The thing that moves me most is because, you know, informality and slums and informal settlements in secondary cities in Africa and, of course, lots of South Asia is the majority of the population. But to see how this organisation, Slum Dwellers International, how people come into saving groups, organise, come together, demand some change, is enormously impressive to me and very, very democratic and is a force for transformation. So that isn't so much new technology, but that is participation working. And those people have to come together because things are so bad. And if they, I mean, it's either going to be that or chaos and rioting and criminality. And in fact, I'd say that's why Birmingham in the end changed. You'll either get criminality, disease, trouble, or the professionals start to change. And I think a similar force is at work. So I'm not just being optimistic because it's nice to talk to people. It is a real energy for change.
Enlightened self-interest was the concept.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, the disease has got the rich too.
They did.
Let's not repeat everything that's been said, and I'll focus just a little on the low and high tech when it comes to participation. I think high tech really empowers people from all on all levels. There are so many examples around the world that we only use satellite data to show, for instance, water usage or misusage by farmers and in settlements of the informal settlements in the city. And not as a blame and shame game, but as a capacity tool. So you bring that information down, you show how they can actually change the way they use the water, and all of a sudden that water usage immediately changes. The same for cities, that analysis. Just using satellite data can actually identify where the losses in the systems are, and with simple measures you can actually build a lot of change. For finance, it's the same. In those informal settlements, having access to finance is complex, but with high tech, all of a sudden, and your mobile phone, you can start local banks. They could be on food, water, and so forth. So I think it's critical, but it has to come with a process. And I think, therefore, again, this inclusion that is about, that's a means and a goal in itself. If the process is actually participatory, which is such an easy word, but such a hard thing to get to, then inclusion actually gets a meaning. And then you can use the tools or not, a design process, very high-tech tools to get to that capacity building that strengthens from bottom up. And then I could make a nice connection to the first point. That's not happening in the developing world at all. So participatory processes as in the developing world are often just a line in a book to chart off a plan, instead of that they are actually part of actually building cities. So there's a lot to learn.
Right. One, two, three. Yes. The microphone is behind you.
Hi, my name is Natalia. I'm from the executive LSE Cities, MSc in Cities. And I'm Colombian. I've been living in London for 12 years, and all my experience is in different places, but not in Colombia. yes, it's I'm an architect. And I'm actually very interested about in the urban agenda than the point five, culture of participation and equity. Because Colombia is a country in Latin America of cities. We have around 12 cities that have more than 1 million inhabitants. Everybody knows like about the conflict in Colombia has moved a lot of people into the cities. But it seems to me that one of the challenges that Colombia faces in terms of governance is to talk about equality, poverty, city for all, to be inclusive, because people are afraid about, not about integration, about to be communist in some way, but that's the description. So if I come back to your idea, Tony, like how to convince people quickly about a big idea. So it sounds great, but now when we have we vote in the referendum, not me, but the referendum for peace was voted no.
Second time.
Yes, was voted no because people were afraid to give power to the guerrilla because they talk about an inclusive, a city for all, poverty. So how we can't use those words in a country that people is afraid to go in the wrong direction?
Okay, power of words, interesting. Right, very good. Now, over there, and then.
Hi, I'm Jenny Robinson. I walked down from UCL. So here, I'm interested in the territories of government that are being discussed here. And I'm just wondering whether they're really out of date. So we're talking about trying to devolve powers to local areas when the financial structures around that so determine whether that's meaningful at all. And you know, we see that here in this country, local governments are invited to eat up our built environment to fund everything. So anything can happen in that moment. And we also know that it's something of a myth that local government brings anything closer to people. It may or may not. We're also talking at the other end about metropolitan government. And there's so many ways that you can cut across these huge mega city regions structurally and to organize cooperation. And I would also wonder whether within any particular government you necessarily achieve integration. So you have so many different elements of government, fragmentation, competition between different agendas, different institutions. So if I put that institutional stuff on the one side, and then on the other side we look at what's the territorial structure of the urban. It's massively spread out. It's formed by all sorts of connections and flows. The relevant actors are multinational corporations, huge big developers, international aid companies. You know, the structure of urban governance is very exteriorized. So I would wonder, you know, multi-level governance doesn't really get it. So what would be a really good thing for such an international policy to seek to achieve? Where exactly do we find effective control, accountability, and I'm not sure it's through these very tired rhetorics of local government or, you know, metropolitan government. We really look at something much more complicated. And I'm just wondering whether anything was going on in the discussions that might head us to think about that.
Wow. Okay. You're all pessimistic, I think, but we come to bring optimism to your worries.
Hi, I'm Ben Plowd and I work for Transport for London, which is part of the devolved administration in London. Philip put up six principles which look suspiciously like the basis for an index of quality of governance for cities. Governments, both national and regional, are quite interested in where they sit on indices of child welfare, prosperity, livability. I wonder whether any efforts have been made to rank cities on some composite index across those six principles, and if not, whether that would help force governments to think about where they sat, assuming they agreed with the ranking, or whether they did or not, in some global score of how good their governance was, particularly if it was correlated to quality of life, which I suspect it probably would be.
Okay, I'm going to ask the panellists to respond to those, and then I'm going to ask the audience, anybody's got, just wait, because we're going to run up to 8 o'clock, any sharp, simple ideas that would help make the kind of process that Philip was discussing more effective, something that would make it more likely to get through, delivered effectively, quickly, given that we've just heard from Claire that the previous efforts perhaps didn't work through too well. Who'd like to go first this time? Claire.
You've been to Medellin, or have you, because you're too busy in London. I've been there. Yes, I know, but and it was the most violent city in the world, and then in order to transform it, connect up the slums, give people transport links so they can get jobs. It was to get peace and decency in the city, they had to reach out to the dispossessed. I mean, if you want a safe city, so that's hope over fear. But this is the perpetual issue of politics all over the world throughout history, and at the moment we're in a period of fear. But if people are divided and fear is fed, you can't get solutions. So that is the battle. And to get decent local communities, you have to bring people together, as they did in Medellin. And of course, you had your referendum second time round, and it came right the second time, a bit like the EU. To the long question about what works, and your last point, Tony, Cities Alliance working in secondary cities in many African countries and in Vietnam and so on, brings together central government, local government, and informal populations, slum dwellers, to hammer out an urban strategy and a sense of priorities and an ability to work together. And it works. I mean, it needs more investment coming in behind it, but it's remarkable that you can get some sort of transformation in the relationships and the sense of priorities, partly because the issues are so urgent that you can't just ignore them. And it brings change. So, I mean, I just give that as an example that works. And then on indices, UCLGA, the Africa branch of UCLG, does an indicators of competence in local government, which I think they're doing it, and I think it's very interesting because it's upping the ante on showing you can do it. And, of course, in lots of small cities in Africa, They don't have any planners. They don't have any water engineers. They don't have... So just getting that to be an issue is very important, and an indicator is helping.
Hank.
There's a... I don't want to be more negative. Be a little bit careful at the end of the evening, but you need to show the result, because otherwise, you know, the agenda is a mechanism to help change the world. Now, what I come across a lot is we collaborate, governments from all layers, multi-donor organizations, NGOs, academia, experts, try to find the solutions. So the hope is out of the room. So next to putting a lot of attention on these collaborations that will find sustainable solutions for future challenges, it's actually changing the way how our funding streams work. Because if we don't actually are able as an international community in all places to showcase that those solutions fit funding streams and have impact around the world, there will be more fail or disappointment. So that's one thing where we try to work with the MDBs, with the findings, and with the donors to say, if you don't change with the Urban Agenda, the SDGs, the Paris Agreement, and the Addis Ababa Agreement, which actually is just between the lines and their processes are not changing at all, then there will be no impact and all the effort of collaboration will be lost. Then again, if we do that, then we can actually create impact that can build trust. And that can only happen in an inclusive and participatory project process.
Ginny, to your point, I think the fact that we have urban conversations badly and that we're not very good at them doesn't mean that we shouldn't be having them and that there aren't important conversations to have. And the reason that I say that is that it's very clear that the world changes around us. When we look back, they've always been talking about cities. Rome spoke about cities. Imperial cities were a major conversation of their time. I think when we look back historically, the dominance of the conversation by nation states that takes place in the post-Second World War period has removed the discussion about cities in a way, and certainly about the diversity of cities, that has left us quite inarticulate. And so for me, part of the importance of a discussion like this is about grappling with, is it important that it's the North and the South? What is it that's important about that? Is it important only for investment, or is it important ecologically? And that we begin to develop a critical language that makes cities legible and makes us understand why they really are probably the things that are transformative of not just our future, but of a common future. And so I suppose that, for me, is that sort of starting point of saying, if you accept the premise, cities are important, there is no future without a city, then developing a language to talk about it and to contest that language becomes one of the most important things that we do. I'm very happy to accept that we're still in 101.
Yes, I also wanted to respond to Jenny's point and again just offer a observation how at this level of the conversation and thinking for in these UN processes we ultimately engage with, yes, terminology we are all tired of, you know, whether it's decentralization, metropolitan governance and so on. But I think what we need to accept that this is an exercise in empirics. We are basically scanning the horizon and we're trying to learn from things that have already happened. It's not theory. It's not grand sort of revolutionary and utopian thinking. That doesn't take place in these contexts. People come with their suitcase and they'll refer to specific places. They've done it here and there and we have learned. And therefore you're locked into something which is a bit tiring because it continues to referring to the same sort of models. But maybe this is just as good as it gets at that level. And therefore I think I'm more, you know, I guess happy to embrace it and then push it as far as possible.
Right. I think I'm going to make a management decision. It's 8 o'clock. The fire alarm is continuing in a very, very, very British way we've carried on regardless. which I apologise, really. I'm probably getting in trouble for this. So I won't ask you for all your ideas, but before you all leave, we'll take another 1 minute of risk. First to thank our four panellists, and Philip in particular, for starting us off this evening. So to Henk, Claire, Sue, Philip, thank you all. Just to conclude, I mean, I think what we've discussed this evening is the fact that multinational institutions or international institutions can provide a framework for thinking about regional city issues, but that at the same time there has to be action at the city level, institutions at the city level, and a willingness to discuss the issues raised, propagated at these international network level at the city level. And it's got to bite there, and in the end people have to want it to happen, and that hasn't got to be just political elites, but it has to be those who participate in more than voting in elections. One final point. The LSE was created by Sidney and Beatrice Webb, who invented or were responsible for something called Fabian socialism. But the other thing that they were also responsible for was massive work on local government, as it was then called, and about equalisation systems and inspectorates to ensure that there was equity between areas and that local public services were run well but without being run from the centre. They did that 120 years ago, and their principles still, I think, much to be admired. Anyway, whatever your politics, thank you all for coming. Thank my panel, and good night.